Om Namah Shivaya. Dear listeners of Shaivam.org, the next program is Spiritual Discourse. In this, you are about to listen Kawai Hindu Lectures. The titles are World Ashram, Introduction to Mamsani Book Awareness Will, presented by Sri Shivaya Bodhiyada Velayada Swami. Thank you. Om Namah Shivaya.
In today's Master Course lesson, the Living with Shiva lesson is about television and has an interesting slant on it. So I thought I'd read that, comment on it, and start with an introduction. So television is a lot like the world. In other words, the world is what we make it. Yoga Swami says the world is an ashram, a training ground for the achievement of moksha, liberation. Well, for that to be true, you have to make it that way. You have to hold that perspective. In other words, depending on the perspective we have, that's what the world is to us. You know, so if you picture typical high school teenagers, what's the world? It's a place to go out and party, right? Place to have fun. To some people, the world, that's a place where we're going to get rich. This is offering us lots of money. That's our focus. Others are focused on fulfilling a profession. And some just like to go out in the world to make friends. You know, so the world is what we make it. It's not something unto itself that we all look at the same way. So certainly when it comes to looking at the world as an ashram, the idea is when we're out in the world, we're concerned about making spiritual progress as well as what else we're doing, be it shopping, making money, or whatever. We're concerned that the way we do that furthers our spiritual progress, doesn't make us stand still or go backwards by how we act. So in that regard, the world is a place where we face our karma. And as Gurudeva points out in this writing on television, I forgot it was there, our karma comes to us through individuals or groups of people normally. So consequently, sometimes we get mistreated in life. The situation isn't working out fairly. We're being treated in a way that's not justified. So how we handle that, of course, relates to karma. The most instinctive response is to retaliate. Well, this person is mistreating me. I'm going to mistreat them in the same way. That idea of retaliation. So, of course, if we retaliate, then we're making a new karma. So that's not causing spiritual progress at all. So in the karma management principles, it talks about that and trying to not retaliate, trying to accept the karma as our creation and ideally even forgiving and forgetting the whole event, not just grabbing onto it and letting it gnaw at us. So we'll look at that at the end. Another part of karma is the new karma we're creating. When we're mistreated by others, it's our old karma coming back to us. New karma, we have an opportunity every time we're out in the world to help others. And it's something we're, you know, we want to instill in our children. Children that go to school, for example, quite often the parents are totally focused on their academics. You know, what grades did you get? But school is also an opportunity to help others, to be of service. And in that way, we're earning good karma, new punyam. So, as I said, television is the same as the world. In and of itself, it isn't a one thing. It can be something different to many different people, depending on how they approach it. So, to read from the lesson, television provides so much of the mental diet of so many people today that it deserves special attention, lest it become a deterrent to a balanced contemplative life. Television at its best is storytelling. We used to sit around and tell stories. The best storyteller who could paint pictures in people's minds was the most popular person in town. Television is also the extension of the little theater, and as soon as it became popular, the little theater groups all over the country became unemployed. It is the extension of the stand-up comedian, a vaudeville, drama, opera, ballet, all of which have suffered since television has become a popular mode of entertainment. In every country, at every point in time, humans have sat down and been entertained, and entertainers have stood up and entertained them. Today, television has become an instrument to convey knowledge and bring the world together, set new standards of living, language, styles of dress and hair, ways of walking, ways of standing, attitudes about people, ethics, morality, political systems, religions, and all sorts of other things from ecology to pornography. This vast facility unifies the thinking and thus the actions of the peoples of the world. Today, at the flick of a finger with the magic wand, one can change the mental flow and emotional experience of everyone watching for the entire evening. So here's the interesting part. Saivites know that our karmas are forces we send out from ourselves, creative forces, preserving forces, destroying forces, and a mixture of either two or the three, and they usually come back to us through other people or groups of people. Television has afforded us the ability to work through our karmas more quickly than we could in the agricultural age. On TV, the other people who play our past experiences back to us for us to understand in hindsight are actors and actresses, newscasters, and the people in the news they broadcast. Saivites know nothing can happen physically, mentally, or emotionally, but that it is seated in our prarabdha karmas, the action-reaction patterns brought with us to this birth. Therefore, on the positive side, we look at television as a tool for karmic cleansing. So that's a different way of looking at it, right? Television is a tool for karmic cleansing. Saivites know that the object of life is to go through our experiences joyously and kindly, always forgiving and compassionately understanding, thus avoiding making unseemly kriyamana karmas in the current life which, if enough were accumulated and added to the karmas we did not bring into this life, would bring us back into another birth, and the process would start all over again. The great boon that television has given humanity, which is especially appreciated by Saivites, is that we can soften our prarabdha karmas very quickly by analyzing, forgiving, and compassionately understanding the happenings on the screen. As our past is portrayed before us, and we work with our nerve system, which laughs and cries, resents, reacts to, and avoids experiences on the television. Television can be very entertaining and helpful, or it can be insidiously detrimental, depending on how it is used. Therefore, fortify your mind with a thorough understanding of what you are watching. Television works on the subconscious mind. This is an area of the mind which we are not usually conscious of when it is functioning, but it is functioning nevertheless constantly, 24 hours a day. Television works strong in the subconscious minds of children. If they watch TV for long periods of time, they begin to think exactly as the programmers want them to think. Responsible parents have to choose just what goes into their children's minds as well as into their own minds. It is advisable to pre-record the shows you wish to watch, avoiding sexual scenes, obscene language, and excessive violence. And even then, be ready to fast-forward through inappropriate scenes that are found today, even on PG-rated programs. So that's a very interesting idea. that television, when approached in the right way, as we talked about, it's all in our approach or our attitude toward it, is a tool for karmic cleansing. So next time someone criticizes you for watching too much television, you can say, I'm just cleaning my karmas. Been cleaning them all day long. So, and specifically, as Gurudeva says, it's softening our Prarabdha karmas. Meaning, we understand our pattern better, and when the karma comes back to us, it comes in a gentler way. That's what soften means. So the karma comes to us, but we've been getting ready to receive it by understanding the nature of this kind of action and reaction by watching it on television. So when it comes, we don't react as strongly. It comes in a gentler way, and the whole process is, as Gurudeva says, softened. It doesn't get rid of the karma, but it softens it, meaning it comes back in a gentler, less disruptive way. So to remind us of the first three principles of karma management, which is what we're talking about. First principle, forego retaliation. We mentioned that. And Gurudeva's quote is, as long as we react, we must repeat it. That is the law. Second principle is accept responsibility. And the quote from Gurudeva on that one is, as long as we externalize the source of our successes and failures, we perpetuate the cycles of karma, good or bad. There is no one out there making it all happen. Our actions, thoughts, and attitudes make it all happen. We must accept and bear our karma cheerfully. And then the third principle is forgive the offender. And we don't have a quote from Gurudeva, we have the Tirukkural quote there. If you return kindness for injuries received and forget both, those who harmed you will be punished by their own shame. Now, isn't that high-minded? You retaliate, but you retaliate with kindness. Something they weren't anticipating, And so they realize, or sometimes they realize that there's a better way of doing it. That's the point. Punished by their own shame means they realize their approach is not a high-minded approach. It's an ordinary or low-minded approach, and there's a more cultured way of handling these kinds of things. So one last quote. This is kind of the grand quote from Gurudeva on karma. Bhakti brings grace, and the sustaining grace melts and blends the karmas in the heart. In the heart chakra, karmas are in a molten state. The throat chakra molds the karmas through sadhana, regular religious practices. The third eye chakra sees the karmas, past, present, and future, as a singular oneness. Meaning it sees them without a sense of time. And the crown chakra absorbs, burns clean enough of the karmas to open the gate, the door of Brahman, revealing the straight path to merging with Shiva. That's a great quote. Om Namah Shivaya. Have a wonderful phase. Good morning, everyone. Thought I would read from today's Living with Shiva lesson on taming distraction. Throughout your inner investigations in meditation, cling to the philosophical principle that the mind doesn't move. Thoughts are stationary within the mind and only awareness moves. It flows from one thought to another as the free citizen of the world travels through each country, each city, not attaching himself anywhere. So that's our perspective. Rudeva calls it the Shumif perspective in the Shum language of looking at the mind as stationary and ourselves as a traveler, as awareness that travels through the mind. So it means that all states of mind are always there. So different states of inner peace, inner light, they're always there. They don't come and go. We don't create them. We move awareness into them. So it makes it easier to experience them if we think of it that way, that we don't have to do anything to create it. It's always there. We just have to find it. When you are able, through practice, to sit for 20 minutes without moving even one finger, your superconscious mind can begin to express itself. It can even reprogram your subconscious and change past patterns of existence. This is one of the wonderful things about inner life. That's why it's inner life. It happens from the inside. If you just sit and breathe, the inner nerve system of the body of your psyche, your soul, begins to work on the subconscious to mold it like clay. Awareness is loosened from limited concepts and made free to move vibrantly and buoyantly into the inner depths where peace and bliss remain undisturbed for centuries. However, if you move even a finger, you externalize the entire nervous system. Like shifting gears from high to low, you change the intensity of awareness and the outer nerve system then is active. Superconscious programming ceases, awareness returns to the body and the senses, and the external mind takes over. By sitting still again at this point, it is just a matter of a few minutes for the forces to quiet and awareness to soar in and in once again. So that's a important point that Gurudev is making, the benefits of not moving when we're practicing meditation. Other times it's fine. But when we practice meditation, the goal is to sit in a way where we don't move. So of course that takes practice. It's not something we can necessarily do the first time we try it. Depends on lots of things. But what is helpful is two practices. One is Hatha Yoga, just practicing Hatha Yoga regularly, because Hatha Yoga in our system of postures is tying the breath in to movement, and it helps the nervous system adjust in a way where it's easier to sit still without moving. So regular Hatha Yoga is helpful in this practice. As well as before, at the beginning of the meditation, we do the pranayama, we do the regulating of the breath for a number of minutes. And so that process is also, again, helpful in being able to sit without moving. So as Gurudeva points out, it's not a crisis if you move, it's just takes a few minutes to build back up to where you were in terms of being internalized. So every time you move, you're starting over, in a sense, a certain process, but you can go through it more quickly a second or a third time than you did the first time. So it's not like you're totally starting over in terms of time, but you're starting over in terms of the process involved of internalizing. As you sit to meditate, awareness may wander into past memories or future happenings. It may be distracted by the senses, by a sound, or by a feeling of discomfort in the body. This is natural in the early stages. Gently bring awareness back to your point of concentration. Don't criticize awareness for wandering, for that is yet another distraction. Distractions will disappear if you become intensely interested and involved in your meditation. Such a state, you won't even feel the physical body. You've gone to a movie, read a book, or sat working on a project on your computer that was so engrossing you only later discovered your foot had fallen asleep for half an hour because it was in an awkward position. Similarly, once we are totally conscious on the inside, we will never be distracted by the physical body or the outside. So that's pointing out we need to be interested in what we're meditating on. Distractions will disappear if you become intensely interested and involved in your meditation. So there's many types of meditations, and our type of meditation, based in the Shum language, we're trying to experience something specific. Go to a specific place, experience a specific state of consciousness, feel a specific energy. So one of the basic inner goals is the energy of the spine, the positive energy of the spine, which in the Shum language is called Simshumbisi. So it's not that difficult to feel if you go through the preparation for meditation, the steps that precede it. Anyone who can get through those steps can feel the energy of the spine. The challenge, of course, is to get interested in it enough for awareness to stay there and not ramble off onto some other journey, shall we say. So Gurudeva describes it nicely in the Mamsani booklet, the 12 Basic Meditations. It's in the Mamsani for the month of May. One of our most powerful Mamsani is Simshumbisi Nimp Kaif. The wavy line represents awareness flowing, Nimp. Awareness flowing from one area of the mind to another is called Nimp. Here it flows from the fourth dimension, where Simshumbisi is, into the seventh dimension, where awareness is completely aware of itself, Kaif. This Mamsani you can live with all of the time. Carry it with you on a little card in your pocket all month long. It's the easiest one, the most vital one, and one of the most powerful. Feel the power within your own spine when you meditate on Simshumbisi. The Mamsani tells us that until we are aware of being aware in the blissful... The Mamsani tells us that until we are aware of being aware in the beautiful bliss of Kaif, where awareness does not move because it is so centered within itself, we must constantly be centered in Simshumbisi. Whenever you are not feeling quite up to par, remember this Mamsani and move awareness into Simshumbisi. Sit, breathe, become aware of simply being aware of these inner energies deep within the spine. These energies come from the central source of it all. Then feel yourself going in and in and in into the seventh dimensional area of the mind, Kaif, being aware of simply being aware. This state is not beyond your reach. It does take a little bit of quieting down, however, but not a great deal of spiritual unfoldment is needed. It is very easy to attain Kaif. Just try. You will see for yourself just how easy it can be. So it's a good goal in meditation, and if our meditation kind of gets off track, we're meditating and we kind of get distracted, start planning what's for dinner, or worrying about a business problem, or other things, a good way to get back into the meditation is to focus on Simshumbisi, because it's a tangible experience. It can be a very dynamic experience, really make us feel positive and centered in the moment. So that's why Gurudeva stresses it so much. When the mind is trying to go here or there, doesn't quite make it, you know, bring it back to Simshumbisi and get centered again, and then try for a deeper state. That's the idea. Thank you very much. Om Namah Shivaya. from today's Living with Shiva lesson, awareness, will, and life force. The primal life force, ever resident within the body, emotions, and mind of man, is, when used or allowed to function, what I term willpower. Now we can see that the ever-present persistence of life force gives an overabundance of willpower, and with it the ability to direct it from deep within. This ability to direct the willpower is the jhana, the wisdom we seek. We have but two choices: to gain jhana through learning the tried and tested set patterns for living and conducting ourselves, or through assuming a relaxed approach of ignorance, be guided by the good and bad and mixed emotional forces of the wills of others. So that's a good point, and why religion gives practical guidelines. It's trying to have us learn through understanding the set patterns for living and conduct, which in our tradition are called the yamas and niyamas. The more we can learn from others, the less we have to learn through our own trial and error experiences. But and it's particularly relevant to parents of older children. You know, we can't take away the need to learn through trial and error. In other words, children just aren't going to learn everything by following the rules of conduct and by the wisdom of their parents. Some things they're going to try out on their own, even though we wish they wouldn't. And we have to have the patience and understanding to work with them when that happens. I remember the former mayor, Marianne Kusaka, was explaining how it is in schools. She used to be a school teacher, that you try and train the kids not to go out on the weekend and party on the wrong things. A lot of time is spent in the schools explaining this, but lots of kids go out and do it anyway because they're not able to learn through the explanation of someone else. They're not able to learn from the experience of someone else. They need to go out and experience this particular thing themselves. So the more we can learn from the experience of others and follow the guidelines, then the quicker our progress in life, certainly. Therefore, the devotee seeks to gain the conscious control of his own willpower, to awaken knowledge of the primal force through the direct experience of it, and to claim conscious control of his own individual awareness. Thus we can begin to see that our individual awareness, willpower, and the primal life force deep within body, emotion, and mind are in fact one and the same. That willpower, individual awareness, and life force, their habits and usages, are but various aspects. So this is a great meditation, and that willpower, energy, and awareness are the same thing. It's three different ways of looking at the same thing. So what's an example of that? Well, the example that Gurudeva gives somewhere in the Master Course, I remember, is a young man at the end of a long work day is kind of tired, and then a friend invites him to a party, and all of a sudden he's energetic. So, you know, we have energy when we're interested in something. It's the interest or the presence of awareness that gives us energy. You've probably noticed that, and sometimes something's kind of hard to do because you're not that enthusiastic about it, you're not that interested in it, and therefore you can't seem to find the energy to do it. So Gurudeva's approach would be, well, try and find a way of looking at it that's more interesting, that captures your interest more. And if you can find another way of looking at it that's more interesting, you'll find you have more energy for finishing it, for doing it well, than you had before. So it's a very interesting point that with awareness, which means with interest, comes energy. Just automatically is there. You will notice that through our study together, these three aspects are referred to time and time again, individually as well as collectively. However, in the study of yoga, it is important to keep in mind the totality of their sameness in order to fully identify your personal and continued experience of yourself as a being with unlimited will, constantly and fully aware of the primal life force flowing through the body and emotions as you, awareness, travel through the mind. This is the goal of the Yani, the one who has attained to wisdom, to the acquisition of divine knowledge and the personal experience of what he has learned. A child in his early years becoming acquainted with living with his family on this planet will show tendencies toward a quiet, peaceful will or a provocative willfulness. The wise parent teaches the culture and etiquette of the household and the community at large, ever endeavoring to bring forth the inner knowledge within the child as to the wise use of his willpower, guiding him carefully away from impulsive, willful behavior, so that little by little he becomes responsible for the action he causes as well as its reactions. So that's saying in a cultured household we try and teach the consequences so children understand and therefore learn to think about what's going to happen if I do this. You know, what's it going to cause? What's the reaction to this action going to be? How is it going to influence me and others? The unwise parent with no particular cultural heritage, completely vulnerable to his own instinctive impulses, overlooks this area of childhood training. Therefore, impulsive willfulness bursts forth from within the children, cultivating abilities to hurt themselves as well as others, and to upset the home with no particular remedy in view. This, of course, is the opposite to what we have in mind to obtain for ourselves. It is the attainment of that ever-collected mastery over our faculties through holding our inner perspective of them that keeps a heavy rein over the aspect of awareness called willpower, maintaining an even balance between the emotional, instinctive, the intellectual, and the spiritual aspects of our being. In other words, will needs to be governed by intelligence. You know, we want to encourage the use of willpower. We need a strong willpower. We want children to grow up with a willpower, but we want them to learn to govern it with intelligence or use it wisely. It is through the study of Raja Yoga, while always holding a silent overview as to what you are learning and how it relates to your particular life patterns, that you will come to know that an inner change is taking place. Harness the powers of your will in the ways indicated. The reward is simultaneous with the effort employed. The results are immediate. So some other material on willpower. Willpower is part of the niyama, cognition, mati. Mati is to develop a spiritual will and intellect. Willpower is the strength of will to carry out one's decisions, wishes, or plans. People who regularly make plans and fail to carry them out lack willpower. For example, a student often plans to get up early to study for his tests, but always when the time comes, decides to continue sleeping instead. We don't know anyone like that, right? Willpower is channeling the rarefied energies of the body, of awareness itself, into attention and concentration upon everything that we do through the day. How can this be cultivated? So, of course, Gurudeva gives us two keys. You probably remember the two keys to cultivating willpower. Number one, finishing each task that we start. Never starting something and abandoning it. Finishing each task we start. Number two, doing it well. And where David goes on to say, in fact, doing it even better than our expectations. So that's the two-step process for cultivating willpower. Finish each task and do it well. Nothing is done with half our mind thinking about something else. Nothing is dropped in the middle. Developing these two important habits produces an indomitable willpower. So this is one of the points we make in the Work is Worship talk. That we know when we sit down to meditate, we need good concentration and good willpower. And otherwise the mind wanders. So where do we get that? How do we develop it? Well, it's most easily developed in our external tasks. Because it's the same ability. It's easier to see it when we're doing something physical. See our tendency to let the mind wander, think about two things at once. See the tendency not to finish something. See the tendency to make a decision to do something and not do it. You know, it's easier in the external to see these qualities than it is when we're sitting and meditating. But they're the same qualities. So we can strengthen our concentration and our willpower by following Gurudeva's principle of finishing each job we start and doing it well. And then that ability is there. So it starts out in schooling, of course, for children. So doing well in school is an important way that we develop concentration and willpower. And then when we're older in our work, in our tasks, daily tasks, applying that principle, and it develops in that way. So willpower is interesting. Some things, when you use them, you run out. Cook the food, and eat it, you run out, right? You use it up. But Gurudeva says, willpower, the more you use your personal individual willpower, the more willpower you have. So you can't run out of it. You can't use it up. In other words, it's like a muscle. Muscle's the same. You know, the more you use a muscle, the stronger it gets. It's the use that strengthens it. So likewise, the more you use your willpower, the stronger it gets. It doesn't run out. Once we have an indomitable willpower, how then can we spiritualize it? We spiritualize it by living a spiritual life. This means controlling our instinctive impulses through following well the yamas. And it means striving to perfect the niyamas, especially contentment, austerity, giving faith, and regular worship. It means holding the attitude, the humble attitude, that our intellectual knowledge produced through memory and reason is quite limited and pales before the knowledge that comes from our superconscious. And it means engaging in regular worship and meditation, in which we strive to personally experience the divine realms of the gods and of our soul. So that's the idea, and as I say, that meditation, that energy, awareness, and willpower are one and the same thing, is a worthwhile one. You can learn something about yourself through pursuing it. Thank you very much. Om Namah Shivaya.